Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. I'm Richard Hill, doing the introduction for a change, and I'm here with my special person and friend and colleague, Matt Darlitz. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Richard. I think it was wonderful to mix it up a bit like that. Welcome to the show, everybody. Today we've got a very special guest from the Queensland Brain Institute, Professor Geoffrey Goodhill. Now, I have had a little bit to do with him recently as we've been shooting some footage for a documentary that we're doing. And what he was doing was so fascinating. I thought, I've got to get him on the show for our listeners. He's an incredibly interesting person, and the work that he's doing is incredibly interesting as well. Richard, can I just tell you a little bit about him?
Well, yes, please do, because what's really a problem that we have, I think particularly in Australia, but certainly different countries, we think all this work is done elsewhere, but actually it's not. We have got this fantastic lab that you have gone in to see. I'm madly jealous because I haven't seen it. So tell us a bit about Geoff. Tell us about the lab.
Yeah, so Professor Goodhill, he was originally trained in mathematics and physics and artificial intelligence and all of these amazing cognitive science, these sort of things in the UK. Then he did a stint in America, but now he's over here at the Queensland Brain Institute, and he's looking at how brains process information, particularly during development. And this is, you know, he's looking at how nerve fibers grow and how the neural maps are created. And he does all of this by observing the zebrafish. And we'll get into the conversation, you know, but the equipment and the technology that they're using and what they're discovering is quite amazing. So we're going to jump into that in just a second. Before we do, let me just mention that if you're new to the brain, well, no one's really new to the brain, are they? But if you're if you're new to the knowledge of the brain, we've got a brain basics bundle, and this is a selection of three courses that Richard and I have done that will give you some professional development points as well, but it will give you the basics of the brain. We've got cortical regions, we've got neuroscience 101 and introduction to the brain. Those three courses, they're all packaged together. I will leave a link in the show notes if you're interested in jumping onto that.
And going back and refreshing your basics is really important. And I know I do it. And it was a fabulous thing about doing the course because it got me to go back to basics. You get sort of into all the detail and some of the stuff, and you forget what the set of steps that get you to where you are. So I love the course. I go back and check it out myself every now and again.
Wonderful. Okay, so Richard, let's go across to the Queensland Brain Institute, where we have Professor Geoffrey Goodhill. Professor Geoffrey Goodhill, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Hi, Matt. Great to join you.
And welcome from me too. I'm very excited to be talking to you today.
Hi, Richard.
Now, Geoffrey, you work at the Queensland Brain Institute, and you're doing some wonderful fundamental research. I'm wondering if you can just give us a little bit of an introduction on how you got to be there and work with these amazing little animals that we'll talk about in just a moment.
Certainly. So I actually have a joint appointment between the Brain Institute and the School of Mathematics and Physics at the University of Queensland. So my original training was actually in maths and physics, and originally I wanted to be study quantum physics and so on. And I certainly enjoy studying that at university. But by the time I finished my degree, I decided that was perhaps enough of that for the time being. And I wanted to do something different. And I played music for a while and tried to make a living at that and discovered how hard that was. And then I got interested in artificial intelligence, and I did a master's degree in artificial intelligence. And through that, I began to get interested in how real brains work. And so I did a PhD in cognitive science and studied neural network models for brain development, particularly in the visual system. And then that was all in the UK. Then I moved to the US and did postdoctoral work in this area of computational neuroscience, which is using mathematical and physics ideas to try and understand computations that brains perform. And then I got a faculty position at Georgetown University Medical School in Washington, D.C., and continued my research in computational neuroscience. And then in 2005, I moved to University of Queensland.
Wow, so you're a real multidisciplinary. And
And what did you do? What did you do in your spare time?
Yeah.
But I think it's fascinating. You sit there, you're saying you did studies and deep things and hard work, and then you thought, wow, I think I'll go off and be a musician. It's amazing how polymorphic a lot of people who work in this area are, because we are sitting here. Matt is a composer and keyboard player and construction. I was an actor. I'm also a songwriter, and there you are. So all three of us have this other way of expressing the way our brain works, which is not. So it's not just about when people talk about, oh, you're just all academic and you're all really dry and you're all really boring. Well, actually, no. We've got a fascinating view of the world, which can pinpoint on both just right-brained frameworks of creativity and expression, as well as this very fine-pointed, detailed work. And I think the connection of those two things, Joseph Ledoux, who we all know very well and things, with his mad amygdaloids, it's just really interesting that we're not just in it for the fine, detailed science. We're in it for there's something else going on in our brains. And that's what interests me about why someone would study a fish.
Tell us about the zebrafish in your lab.
Right. So the reason we study zebrafish is because they're just a fantastic model system for asking certain kinds of questions in neuroscience. So what's great about zebrafish is that they grow up very quickly. And so we're particularly interested in brain development. So it's a very nice system for looking at brain development. And also zebrafish, young zebrafish are transparent early on. And you can insert genes which make the calcium in their neurons glow fluorescently. And when a neuron fires, the level of calcium inside the neuron increases. And so this means we can directly visualize neural activity in the zebrafish brain by putting it under a microscope and looking at changes in fluorescence levels. So that's a readout of neural activity. So in other words, we can take a very young zebrafish while its brain's just forming, you know, equivalent to very, very early stages of human brain development, and we can see how the firing of these neurons is starting to emerge and how it's starting to represent information about the world. So we record both spontaneous activity when there's no stimuli and also activity in response to visual stimuli. We present simple visual stimuli to the fish and look at how the brain starts to form representations such that the fish can understand what those patterns of visual stimulation mean.
Now I'm just saying, sorry, Matt, I just quickly, but with that, by the fluorescence, you're able to look at almost individual neuron functioning as different from the lighting up that we do with fMRIs, which is really quite club-fisted and grouped.
That's a very good point. Yes. Yeah. So one of the fantastic advantages of this system is that we can look at these patterns at the level of single neurons. So we can easily distinguish single neurons. So in something like fMRI, you're averaging over the activity of millions of neurons.
Mm.
And obviously that can answer some kinds of questions. But obviously the system like the zebrafish, where you can look at the activity of individual neurons, but many of them at the same time, allows you to ask different kinds of questions.
Yeah. Now, I've been in the lab and I've seen some images of these neurons firing up, and it's quite amazing. We might point our listeners to a little bit of a video clip of that so they can actually see what you're seeing. And it's kind of like what you would imagine if you could look into a brain and see each of the neurons sort of firing, which actually it doesn't really look like that, does it, in reality?
Well, you can't see anything normally looking at the brain. Just that these have been specially manipulated genetically so that
so that they can do this. And this idea of genetic manipulation in these small areas, I know, as I'm reading, certainly we have mice, which is looking at larger beings, but this, the zebrafish and the little roundworm, the Caenorhabditis elegans, that's kind of really interesting, because we're able to get down to this very thing of single neurons, single gene behaviours, and that's really cool.
Yes, and so with the worm, the C. elegans has exactly 302 neurons.
So, wow.
You have about 100 billion, right? And even with just 302, we still don't fully understand how its nervous system works and how it senses the environment and controls behavior. And so obviously the research program, the overall research program idea is, if you can understand, you know, to understand a very complicated system with 100 billion neurons, it might help to understand a much simpler system with 302 neurons. So even though obviously worms do things which are maybe different from humans, if you can't understand that system with 300 neurons, then obviously it's going to be pretty tough to understand the system with 100 billion neurons.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but even with a very simple organism like the worm, and you've got a very accurate map of the neural architecture of the connections, it's still, from a computational neuroscience perspective, it's still very difficult to predict the actions of the worm. Is that right? I mean, if you were to...
And the fish, yeah.
Well, that's right. Yeah, so the fish has about 100,000 neurons at this age, and it's just becoming possible to do whole brain imaging. So most of my work so far has looked at just particular parts of the brain at a time, like the part that processes visual information. But in common with some other labs around the world, we're now starting to look at imaging using new kinds of imaging technologies, imaging the whole brain. So looking at the simultaneous activity of all those 100,000 neurons.
Yeah, this sort of connectome thing that we're seeing some people coming up with.
Right. So, you know, a popular approach in neuroscience at the moment is sometimes called connectomics. And the idea is to try and reconstruct all the connections between neurons, at least in some particular, you know, in the whole of a small organism like a worm, or in a small part of a larger brain. So, for instance, there's a reconstruction of a neural circuitry in a little cube about a tenth of a millimeter big in a mouse, and they're trying to scale that up to a millimeter cubed. And right. So the hope is that by understanding more about the connections, we'll be able to understand more about how the system functions. But certainly the connection is very important. One of the things, as Matt was alluding to, one of the things we've learned about the worm is that we've had that connectional map for quite a while now, but we still don't understand how the whole system works. And so that's an important piece of information, but it's not enough to tell you how the system works.
No, it's like the connections are just the first level of understanding.
Well, they're a particular level. And, you know, there's some controversy in the field of neuroscience about how important that level is. I mean, everybody agrees it's a useful thing to know, but at least with current technology, it requires a massive amount of resources to be able to reconstruct those connections. And so the controversial question is, should those resources be distributed to other kinds of neuroscience questions, or at least some of them?
Well, I just think we should have more and more and answer all the questions. So my next one is just probably something a bit simple, but how similar is a neuron in a zebrafish or the roundworm to the human neuron? What's the evolutionary history there?
So a lot of properties of neurons have been conserved for a very, very long time. So essentially the way a neuron in a zebrafish or a human works, now it is slightly different in the worm, but the way in a zebrafish or a human, the way the neuron works is that it's the inside is negatively charged relative to the outside, and then some inputs come in and raise that potential inside the neuron. And then once it reaches a threshold, the neuron fires a spike of electrical activity. So just about a thousandth of a second long, a little spike of electrical activity travels down connections to other neurons. So that's the fundamental way in which most nervous systems work. Mm. And that basic set of mechanisms has been conserved probably for hundreds of millions of years.
Do they myelinate in the fish the way we do? Do they have the fast and slow neurons, or is it fairly uniform?
There is some myelination in the fish.
Wow. So it's that old. Wow, isn't that fantastic? And what about some of the complexities of neurotransmitters and things? Like, do they have microtubules and vesicles?
Yeah, no, microtubules. So certainly, I mean, all these organisms have microtubules. And a lot of them share the same neurotransmitters. So, the basic neurotransmitters such as GABA, which is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So that's very important in function of the zebrafish brain and also in function of our brains. And glutamate, the excitatory neurotransmitter. So both of those molecules are conserved across many, many different organisms. So you can understand a lot about the basic function of neurons, which apply across many different systems.
And there's just a thought having there, the idea that actually rather than thinking, or not rather than thinking, but one can think of the human brain as an extraordinary piece of architecture. But the other thing is, if this neuronal structure goes way back beyond this, you know, beyond human development, that the human brain is just an interesting development construction of an established architecture that we see everywhere. So there's a lot more similarity, just differences in some of the ways it's put together.
Right. So certainly there are aspects of the human brain which are certainly more complex than any other animals we know. And this is a very active area of research trying to understand exactly what has changed in the brain between, you know, our ape ancestors and us. And so, you know, there's some evidence there may be some new kind of neuron types may have emerged. So there's certainly more complexity there. Yeah. But overall, it's very, you know, it's very much a continuum. And as you're saying, the human brain, you know, has added something on top, but there is, you know, this whole superstructure underneath it, which is essentially conserved with other species.
Can I get back to now what the fundamental research? What are we extrapolating out of that for, you know, our mental health, psychopathologies, that sort of thing? Are you bridging sort of from basic research to?
So it's important to stress that what we're doing is basic research. So
yep.
We're not trying to directly address medical questions. And in common with a lot of biological research, it's essentially trying to understand how this particular biological system works, so that by understanding sort of the basic principles, hopefully in, you know, 10, 20, 30 years time, you know, those ideas or those basic principles can then help us understand, you know, medical issues in humans. So, you know, one of the basic questions we're looking at is the development of the neural code, how these patterns of activity emerge during development. And obviously we don't expect these patterns of activity to be exactly the same in humans as in fish, but hopefully there's some sort of general principles we can extract from that. So, but I was going to add, there is a project that we've recently started doing, which is not exactly translational, but is has a more directly medical focus. And that is looking at zebrafish, which are mutant for certain genes, which in humans would normally cause autism.
Okay.
And so obviously you can't talk about an autistic fish, because it's a human condition. But we can study fish which have mutations in these particular genes. And there's evidence that they have changes in behavior. So for instance, they have changes in their shoaling behavior with other fish as adults. And this is known about brain development. And autism is actually believed in humans to be a disorder of brain development.
Yeah, and this idea that we're able to and probably at this stage where we're at is, as we understand specifics and details about structures and the way things motivate, that we're probably still in the middle of the postulation sort of stage of the proposing stage, where there's it's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing that we're still got an opportunity for scientists to apply their imaginative, well thought out but imaginative frame. But also we have the problem that people are making bold statements that are sounding factual, but it's far too early for that. What are you feeling about that sort of difference?
No, I think you put that very well. We are still at a very exploratory stage, and one of the things I had to get used to moving from maths and physics into neuroscience is that in physics, and you know, even more so in mathematics, you know, there's this fundamental base of knowledge which is pretty much, you know, true is in mathematics, it's absolutely true. In physics, it's you know, unlikely to be completely our perspective is unlikely to completely change anytime soon. Whereas that's really not the case in neuroscience. So I my estimate is that the half-life of information in a neuroscience textbook is probably about 25 years. In that, wow. 25 yeah. years from now, about half of what's in the standard neuroscience textbook will be considered not exactly wrong, but will have will think about it in a different way.
Be reviewed. Yes, we have a lovely friend, Lou Cozzolino, who actually says that in his lectures. He says, you know, 50% of what I learnt was wrong or has changed. And he said, so I suspect 50% of my lecture is going to be changed later. I just can't tell you which 50%. Yeah.
And that's humbling too, isn't it? But also not just humbling, but it's good in terms of research, because if you have that in mind, you're going to be more open, aren't you, to all sorts of different possibilities that may emerge out of this basic research that you're doing.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things I find so exciting about doing this kind of research, is that so much is up for grabs, in a sense. And right. Yet it's so constrained as well by what we already know and understand. So this is, for me, this is one of the most exciting sorts of ways of trying to make progress intellectually. Is not it's not like you have no constraints. You have important constraints, but you have to try and think creatively within those constraints.
Right.
Yes, so I was just going to say, with that lovely thing, Florey, was it Florey? I think you said it. A theory sits on the fingertips to be blown away by the merest fact. and this is the interesting thing, that the work you're doing is providing some of those facts that can take a theory further and deeper into actuality, but also can just blow it away and say, no, wrong thinking, shift your direction. I mean, to me, this is exciting. This makes this an exciting time. You know, you're sort of sitting there imagining yourself just at pre-Einstein and relativity type of time. We haven't got the relativity stuff, but we're...
So, you know, some people would argue we're actually pre-Newtonian.
Pre-Newtonian, perhaps, even. Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, until relativity and quantum mechanics, Newtonian physics could explain almost everything. Mm. And we're so nowhere close to that point in neuroscience.
Wow. Sober up, everybody.
Yeah. So when it comes to, planning ahead, I'm imagining that, you know, you have experiments that you have planned and that you're doing, but really the long road ahead of you, how do you know where to go? How are you steering the ship, so to speak?
Right. So, I mean, my long-term goal is to understand the computations that the brain performs, and particularly how those computations emerge during neurodevelopment. Mm-hmm. And so, keeping that big goal in mind, then in the shorter term, we need to be opportunistic about the technologies available, which can help light on those questions. Very excited about this whole brain imaging technology in Zebra Fish, and we've just been building with our microscope colleagues at the Queensland Brain Institute. We've been building a microscope which will allow us to do that effectively, and so that provides, you know, large amounts of data, so that we can image, you know, the whole volume of the Zebra Fish brain in about a second. So activity of 100,000 neurons once a second, we can do that for hours, and so there's vast amounts of data, and there's obviously a large number of fascinating questions one can imagine asking about a data set like that. But just managing that data is already a challenge. You know, we're talking terabytes of data. Yeah. And so part of the, you know, challenge for my lab is to, and luckily I have people with backgrounds in computer science mm-hmm. and so on, who can help us with that initial stage of just sort of manipulating that data into a form where we can then start asking more mathematically oriented questions.
Now, you come from a AI background as well. So are you using artificial intelligence to help you do the number crunching, so to speak?
Right. So we're using a variety of machine learning techniques. Mm-hmm. And we recently had a project using deep learning to help us with some image segmentation problems. And that in the past few years, deep learning in particular has had a very big impact on a lot of practical data problems in neuroscience. Should I just explain what deep learning is?
Absolutely.
Yes, please. That was the next question. Yeah.
So deep learning is just a nice name for a class of technologies which involve learning in artificial neural networks. And what the deep refers to is just that they're networks which have many layers of neurons. So the idea is a hierarchical network. So information flows into one layer of neurons, gets passed up to the next layer, and then the next layer. That's the hierarchy. And so what's interesting about deep learning, one of the things particularly interesting to me about deep learning is that that whole approach was originally inspired by neuroscience. So the brain seems to operate quite hierarchically. So for instance, when we process visual information, information first is processed in the retina, then in many different areas of the brain in this largely hierarchical way. And so using that as inspiration, these networks, and with a lot of clever mathematical tricks and a lot of data that's now available from the internet and so on, have proved to be incredibly powerful at solving the same kinds of perceptual problems that humans are very good at. And so there's a kind of a loose analogy between the way these networks work and the way real brains work.
Wow. Okay. And there's a little, just don't want to go too far because it's still pretty early days and speculative, but the nature of quantum computing. And we've just actually published a nice piece from my mentor, Ernest Rossi, sort of speculating on some of the new work. And the two things, one is the actually having quantum computers that can do enormous amounts of calculations, which is going to help as different from the analog. But these guys that, and pardon me for getting their names, but they'd recently seen that you and shown that that you can do quantum computing without having an increased number of a depth of field as we have to have in the analog, where you have to have more computer bits. And so that this is also potentially an aspect of the way some of the processing might be done in the brain, that it's done on this level of not requiring masses of greater depth of connections, but can somehow, so this is something, but I don't want to go any further because it's entirely speculative and things, but what sort of, as you've done some research on that, what sort of tickles and fantasies and things are wandering around in that space?
You mean in terms of the potential link with quantum computing?
Well, yes, just how it rates both on that practical side for calculations, but that internal side for mental processing.
Right. So obviously if the brain could exploit these amazing quantum properties, then that would, I mean, it certainly would give it a lot of computing power. I think at the moment, there's no evidence at the moment that it's able to do that. Because, you know, in those quantum computers, the environment has to be very, very tightly controlled.
Yes.
And it's not clear whether the brain would be, or in your body, you would be able to just exert that level of control over, the internal environment of your brain to allow that kind of computing to take place.
Yeah.
But having said that, who knows what things will look like in 50 years. I'm sure we have an awful lot more to discover about quantum computing, and perhaps there's ways to relax some of those constraints.
Yeah, I think insight is probably that, those flashes of insight are probably the place we need to look for the potential for things to be calculated in a non-analogous way. But anyone who wants to give us the $50 million to figure that out, please do so.
I think it might take more than $50 million.
You were talking a little bit about some of the technology that you have that is being able to, look at the brain of the zebrafish. Now, I've been in the lab and I've had a look at this this amazing microscope, which uses lasers. I'm wondering if you could just tell our listeners just a little bit about that piece of machinery, because it's quite incredible.
And that's the one you guys have invented?
No, we didn't invent that. So we are... in common, as I say, with several labs around the world, we're exploiting that technology. But that technology is certainly under rapid development, and so it's still the case that it's each lab is custom building their own for their own particular specifications. But the way that looks, so this is called a light sheet microscope. And so in a conventional, what's called confocal microscope, you use a laser beam to illuminate a small part of the tissue, and you scan that laser beam rapidly across the tissue, and you detect light from each point in that tissue one at a time. Now, with a light sheet microscope, what you do is you spread the beam out into a sheet. So it's a wide, very, very flat sheet. So it's only a few thousandths of a millimeter thick. And with that, we can illuminate a whole plane of the brain at one time. And so that means we can image lots of neurons much faster than in a conventional microscope using sort of a pencil beam laser, where you're just stimulating one very small region at a time. Here we're illuminating a whole plane at a time. And we can move that plane of light up and down through the fish's brain, and they will very rapidly capture the activity of, you know, build up a stack of the activity throughout the whole brain.
Yep. Now, you use a laser that we can see, which I saw, and then you've got another that emits an invisible laser. Is that right?
So that's the distinction between what's called one photon and two photon microscopy. So what we need to do is stimulate these fluorophores, so cause the fluorescence, excite the fluorescence so we can see it. And so we can either use a visible laser of a particular wavelength, which is the wavelength that those molecules need to be excited. Or, but the problem with that is that, you know, that laser has to pass all the way through the tissue, and in the meantime, it's exciting other parts of the tissue as well. And so with a two-photon laser, what you use is this clever trick where you, instead of sending in photons of the energy you need to excite the fluorophore, you send in photons of half the energy you need to excite the fluorophore. But you concentrate the beam such that you make it likely that two of these photons will come together in one particular small volume at the same time. And together they'll combine to produce enough energy to excite the fluorophore. Now, so that has some fantastic advantages. Firstly, because the wavelength is longer, they can penetrate deeper into the tissue. Yep. And secondly, you can then just illuminate one tiny little volume in the tissue. You don't have this problem with stimulating everything along the way, because the two photons only come together at one point. So the single photons just travel through the tissue without exciting the fluorophore. But when they come together at that one point, they excite the fluorophore. That requires, that's one of the main things that makes that tricky, is that requires a much, much more powerful laser, because you have to concentrate all this energy at this point. And so that laser has a power of several watts, which in laser terms is a lot of energy.
It's huge, right?
Well, it sounds like really amazing work that you're doing there, and certainly when I was there visiting the lab, there's certainly a buzz, you know, around the place, and you're certainly on the cutting edge or the leading edge, and that's really exciting.
And the exciting thing, Matt, is that while you're there, because you're taking some filming this work, and to create some kind of documentary or some kind of something. What's going on there?
So we're doing a documentary and it's called Toward Singularity, and it's about going from our amazing brain and how our brain is the inspiration for artificial intelligence, and we're just looking at that. But we're early days, but as we get closer to finishing that production, we'll certainly let our listeners know about that one.
But I think it's exciting is that we don't have to go anywhere to find the fundamental labs and things that are doing this foundational work. It is every country has these sorts of processes, as you were saying, Jeff, that you're doing things in association with other labs, and every country can look to their own people and the connections that their local people have with the international framework, and they hopefully are talking to them in the same way that we're talking to you.
Can I mention at this point that there is actually something called the International Brain Initiative, which is trying to coordinate international brain projects. So the US has a brain project that was originally funded under the Obama administration and is still funded. Japan has a brain project. Korea has a brain project. China has a brain project. And Australia is actually trying to get one going. And it's called the Australian Brain Alliance. And they have a very nice website. And you can go and check out that website. You can, on that website, you can actually sign up to be what they call a brain champion, to tick a box saying that you support brain research. And then this information then goes to the government with the hope that they will put more money into funding brain research.
Oh, I'm going in there 150,000 times.
Okay, wonderful.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Perhaps I should state for the record that this is something that my wife has actually been heavily involved in. And so she's a co-chair of the Australian Brain Alliance, and she's actually the spokesperson for the International Brain
Slightly high-achieving family.
A little, yes.
No, it's wonderful. Well, congratulations to her from us. Yeah,
thank you. Well, Professor Geoffrey Goodhill, it's been so great and very interesting to have you on the show. We love all of this basic research that you guys are doing. I'm slightly jealous. It's wonderful to hear about it all. And I just thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thanks, Matt and Richard. It's been really interesting to talk to you.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful stuff. Thank you. Wow, Matt, I'm a little stumped for words because that is so interesting. It's so detailed and specific, yet so early days and full of possibility. I mean, if you're 20 years old and 18 years old and listening to this podcast, you have just a lifetime of work ahead of you. We haven't, you're interested in neuroscience? No, it's not all done, not by any shot. It hasn't even started. And these guys are showing it. Wow, that was amazing. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that really impressed me was that we are just at the beginning, just at the cusp of, you know, a journey here. We're really pioneering so much in terms of understanding how our brains work. And with the explosion of technology, it really is such an exciting time to get into this whole world of neuroscience.
Yeah, so many of our ideas that people are putting forward now, they're not solid. They're prescient. So now we need to go and get the science to make a good assessment of what's real, what's usable, and then how we do it. But please be imaginative now. Please be imaginative and creative, and just be careful of being definite and sure, because Jeff's going to prove you wrong in about 5 minutes' time.
Absolutely. You know, stay humble and stay open, because we really, we may think that we're very sure about certain things, but like Geoffrey said, you know, half-life of the neuroscience books are probably 25 years, so it may be even less for what we're doing.
Yeah, that's a lovely theme for the science of psychotherapy. Be humble, imaginative, and prepared for change.
Okay, so that was fun, Richard. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week on another episode of The Science of Psychotherapy.
Bye for now. Thanks for listening to The Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.